Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tulsa's John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation will offer its annual national symposium this Wednesday through Friday. The Value of Reconciliation features presentations, lectures, and forums on the value of transcending race and ethnicity, and how institutions ranging from churches, businesses, and think tanks are looking for ways to bring people together and shatter barriers. You can learn more about the symposium at jhfcenter.org. Thursday will feature two free events, a keynote lecture and a town hall with two eminent theologians, Dr. James Forbes, the senior minister emeritus at Riverside Church in New York City, Dr. Donald Shriver of the Union Theological Seminary discussing the value of reconciliation. That's at 3:30. That will be followed by the keynote address given by my guest today, Peter Adelman, professor of law at Georgetown University and one of our nation's foremost anti-poverty activists. Adelman is the author of numerous articles and books, most recently the 2012 book, So Rich, So Poor, Why It's Hard to End Poverty in America. He worked for Robert F. Kennedy and later in the Department of Health and Human Services in the Clinton administration, where he resigned in protest over President Clinton's decision to sign the 1996 Welfare Reform Act. He'll be speaking on ending poverty in America and other prerequisites to reconciliation at 5:30 on Thursday afternoon at the convention site at the Hyatt Regency. He joins me by phone today on Studio Tulsa. Professor Adelman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
As keynote speaker for the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation's National Symposium, when we think about racial reconciliation, today there are many critics of our post-civil rights policies, from the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who said in announcing a decision last term, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of a race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. That's one view. The average person sees a black president, diversity in the highest areas of government, business, entertainment, journalism, all sectors of public life. And they're probably saying, why is it important to look at this? And I want to ask you, why is it important to recognize, acknowledge, and even offer reparations at times for injustices, events of 50, 60, 100, 150 years or more?
We're not done with the job of full inclusion of people of color, African-American, other groups as well, certainly Latinos, Hispanics who have come to this country. That's the basic point, is we still have a long way to go. We have to celebrate the steps forward that we've taken. They're fantastic. Certainly at the top of the list in one way is electing Barack Obama, but that's the result and the culmination of everything else we've done, from Brown v. Board of Education in the Supreme Court, even more importantly, maybe the civil rights movement and what it achieved during President Johnson's presidency, of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 65, Housing Act of 68. So these are all fantastic things. We build up a strong African-American middle class in this country, although like our middle class generally, it's threatened now. But at the same time, particularly and somewhat ironically and surprisingly, since the triumphs of the 1960s, we've had a law enforcement policy that has resulted in a huge number of people being incarcerated, just a huge increase, 2.3 million people now, and they're disproportionately people of color, black and brown. Our public schools have deteriorated, particularly in inner cities, central cities, tremendously, sadly, since the 1960s. And the brunt of that, not just the resegregation that we've had with white flight from cities, but the quality of education, that's really a racial issue in our society. You look at the wage structure in this country, we have this flood of low-wage jobs. Who has those jobs? They're disproportionately people who are African-American and Hispanic.
Those are really pressing problems that, you know, we've been trying to deal with since the 1960s. We really haven't made a whole lot of progress on that. In cases of low-wage jobs, perhaps we're even moving backwards.
The thing that we have to understand is the failures, the fact that we still have actually more poverty now than we had in the 1970s, higher percentage, largely because of the recession, but it is worse. That's not so much because we failed with public policy. The public policies we have, from Social Security to the Earned Income Tax Credit, food stamps, a number of other things, help with housing, these things are keeping 40 million people out of poverty There would be 86 million people who were poor rather than the 46 million whom we count as poor if we didn't have those policies. The real problem is that there has been this tremendous change in our economy, and the manufacturing jobs left, the good jobs left, and we have the jobs that replaced them are really all of these low-wage jobs. And so that's what we haven't faced up to as a country, that there's so many people of all races who are struggling with that. I mean, we always have to remember in a conversation about economics that the largest group who are poor in this country, who actually have incomes below the poverty line, they're white. And the African-American, Latino poverty is disproportionately high. And therefore, we need to have this continuing conversation about race. But the fact is, the economic problems cut across all races.
Earlier, you mentioned these three areas. Do you see the most important work of racial reconciliation is in really addressing things like incarceration rates, where the U.S. incarcerates nearly more per capita than any other country in the world? Public education, especially in central cities, addressing our low-wage jobs. Is that the best way to achieve this reconciliation you're talking about at this point?
Well, the word reconciliation, of course, includes also really some interpersonal relationships. It really is also a question about attitudes and how people treat each other individually and then also as groups. So I do think, though, that the civil rights issues of the 21st century are especially the issues of education, quality education, where the greatest challenge really is for children of color, and what's happened to our criminal justice system. I think those are the major civil rights issues of this century. I do think so.
What would you say to the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, last year, who said the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race? And this was on racial preferences in admission to public universities.
Yes, public schools. It's
public
part
schools,
of the
parents
involved. It's a quote in the parents involved case, which is about voluntary desegregation efforts in Seattle and in Louisville. There are two levels to that. One is that he's just incorrect in terms of the specific subject matter of those two cases. Those are about voluntary desegregation. It's kind of hard for me anyway, and I think for a lot of us who look at the court and talk about the Constitution, to see a voluntary desegregation effort as being discriminating against anybody else. And that's what he's saying. You know, as a general statement, we do want a society that doesn't discriminate against anybody. Of course we do. But over a long period of time, it's also been true that we've said, look, there are still very, very strong vestiges of discrimination, strong continuing effects of the history of discrimination in this country. And that's why we've had these efforts to say we're going to allow race to be taken into account in university admissions. That's the Grutter case in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Where we thought that I didn't even think there was a constitutional question about voluntary desegregation in the K-12 system, because that actually doesn't even involve any issue about some sort of preference. The basic point here, Justice O'Connor said in the Grutter case that she thought we really needed to give ourselves 25 more years during which we continue to work toward ending the residual effects of discrimination by having allowing race to be taken into account in university admissions anyway. So, you know, if you read the school desegregation cases back into the 70s, they always said we don't expect to be doing that forever. But the question is when are we're really done? When have we finished the job? And I think we've still got some work to do.
Well, the conference theme is on the value of reconciliation. I imagine a good part of your remarks will be directed towards a different reconciling, and that's how government shapes its policy towards our poorest citizens. You write in your book, So Rich, So Poor, that poverty in governmental circles has become a red flag word. You really can't get anything done on poverty anymore.
That's true now in terms of the national government. You know, it does in the at the state level. It varies by the state, but this is a tough time to get anything done in Washington. There's so much of a division and so much hostility back and forth. And yes, at the moment, I think because of the economic difficulties in the country, people are, you know, they are legitimately worried about their own situation, and that means that it's turned into a politics of not being very responsive to the needs of other people who are having a tough time. Anyway, we've done a lot, as I said, with public policy, in national policy, in federal policy, but right now it's a time. I had a member of Congress talking to her a couple of years ago who explicitly said to me that she found absolutely no positive response when she would suggest some kind of action about poverty. And she said you had to have a homeless veteran before you got any kind of a rise out of anybody.
And this is at a time when the poverty rate is rising.
Well, it is, and it's a time when whatever the economists say and whatever we see in the stock market, people in this country are having a very tough time. That means people have been out of work for a very long time, and they have a continuing need for help. And that's kind of the new poor, if you will, the long-term unemployed, many of whom, anyway, if not most, are people who became unemployed in the recession. But just in general, we should be thinking about where we are right now in terms of putting people to work, because the unemployment situation is still very much like a recession, even if it's not, it is a recession, even if it's not officially a recession. So we've got that wrong. In fact, if we were to use public policy to put people to work, that would put money in people's hands from work, and they would spend that, and it would stimulate the economy. So it would not only be good for the people who were put to work, but it would actually be good for the recovery of the economy. But that's not the way. Too many people in Washington don't see it that way.
My guest today is Peter Adelman, a professor of law at Georgetown University, a longtime anti-poverty activist. He's the author of the 2012 book, So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. He'll be the keynote speaker for the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation's National Symposium. It's a free public address Thursday at 5:30, and he joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things you've talked about several times in our minutes together has been this fear of becoming a low-wage nation. And really, when I look at your book, you had this great statistic that I think should be screamed at the top of everyone's lungs, is that for a lot of middle-class professions, I think people tend to think, I'm in the middle. And you, as you write, said half of all American jobs pay less than $34,000. I think for a lot of people who think they're in the middle, they find they're well above the middle.
That is true. And we might say upper middle, but since we're such a wealthy country, the numbers, not only as to that the $34,000 being the median. In other words, all jobs, of all the jobs, half of them pay less than that, if you have that job all year long and full-time, by the way. And, you know, the median household income in the country is...
It's slipping.
It's slipping, and it's $50-some thousand. So we're just not being conscious of how skewed where the money goes, how skewed that is. You know, during the last now 40 years, the kind of watershed year in all of this was 1973. We'd been on a very strong growth path from World War II until then, which was helpful across the board in terms of race and ethnicity. Black men had a big increase from 1945 to 1973, and then Everything started going in the other direction. But our economy grew. It's just that it was not just people who we call poor, but really the whole lower half got stuck. And yet our economy is twice as big. Well, it all stuck at the top. It's all the top 1% that got the fruits of that growth. And, you know, we should be shouting that as well. From 2009 to 2011, the latest numbers that we've seen, the top 1% income grew. And remember, this is still recession time, grew by 11%. The entire other 99% lost 0.4%. And, of course, you better believe that the 99 didn't lose at the same rate as the 1. So, I mean, right there in the middle of the recession, the top are making out like bandits and everybody else is hurting.
So what changed in 73 or what changed about that time? Do we start lowering tax rates? What exactly?
What changed is the nature of our economy. And this is so everybody kind of knows it, what happened to the economy. They don't sort of think about how it connects to what happened. What happened is that the manufacturing economy that we had, which, by the way, was based on jobs where you didn't have to finish high school and where people went to work in the steel plants and in, you know, a variety of industries across the country and had a wonderful outcomes. And this was particularly helpful to African-American, and there weren't so many Latino people or Hispanic people then. But globalization is what did it, one word. And then there's what happened to the unions. They became less and less of a force, and the minimum wage just got stagnant. There were a number of other things, and then family structure changed. So that's obviously something that is complicated and is a discussion in and of itself. But the economics of that is that just when there were all these low-wage jobs, there were so many families, an increasing number of families then, where you only had a single mom, only one person who could go out to work. And the job available wasn't enough to live on. So that all came together starting in the 70s, and it has put us in this situation where we have this flood of low-wage jobs.
Now, one of the points your book makes is that you have a lot of people who vote against their economic interests, and one of the reasons that you write about is the idea of social mobility. It's a long-cherished ideal. It's something that has always set our nation apart, this idea that you can start at the Horatio Alger story, the idea that you can be a self-made person. But, you know, when you look at that, it's been the exception rather than the rule, except for that generation you're talking about after World War II, maybe also the beginnings of universal education at the beginning of the century. How does this idea of ideal of social mobility affect our policies towards those in poverty? It makes us less inclined to help, doesn't it?
I think it does. Just for kind of the concepts in the conversation, two kinds of mobility. One is absolute. That's where everybody's going up. And so even if you stay at the bottom of the pile, you know, you could do better. Absolute mobility.
The tide that lifts all boats, right.
Mm-hmm. The tide that lifts all boats. Well, absolute mobility stopped. And then, of course, when you have no overall increase except the absolute mobility of the people at the top who are just going up and up, but at least the bottom being stuck on the absolute, it also becomes very difficult to do the other kind, which is the relative mobility. That's where you pass somebody up. And, you know, if there isn't much action going on there at the bottom, you're certainly not going to pass anybody up. So both of those things have been stuck for people. Now, you know, you look, and it's always true that there are remarkable young people who grow up. We're celebrating John Hope Franklin at this event in Tulsa. People who are so remarkable that they rise to the top, and it's like an inverted funnel, you know, where there's a little room for people to get on through that. You could say that's Barack Obama. But real issue here is that the large number of people with those, shall we say, limited exceptions have been absolutely stuck for 40 years. They've gotten more and more angry because they don't quite know what's been going on. And I don't think we've made a significant effort in terms of our elected leadership, in terms of people who lay out ideas in our country, in terms of people who are active in on these issues. I don't think we've made it clear to ourselves as a country that we really have not been doing justice to people who have need to earn more money. That's the first thing. You know, we always want jobs to be the best. They're the best way out of poverty. So the first thing we need are jobs that pay enough, or where we add to that the value of health coverage, for example, or the value of helping children have a chance to go to college. Those are things that are public, where there needs to be public funding. And again, I think we just haven't said to people, look, the way this really works, in effect, for everybody to have a fair share of it, in our country, is that it's a public-private partnership. And instead, there's been, beginning with Watergate and the views in the country, we were divided, of course, but the kind of acid that got thrown on our society through the war in Vietnam, people have stopped trusting government. That's just, you know it. It's just deteriorated in the polls. After World War II, there was, and on into the 60s, there was tremendous trust in government in this country, and that's just so heavily eroded now. So it's hard to say to somebody, you know, the fact is that government is important. It can do useful things for all of us. It has to be, of course, funded to do whatever it's going to do, but people are skeptical about that.
Yeah. One of the interesting things your book points out is I think a lot of people think that we're spending an awful lot of money on anti-poverty programs. And one of the things you point out is that there are 6 million people in the United States that have no income other than food stamps. And in fact, the idea of assistance, money assistance, welfare is what we used to know it by. That number has really not moved since welfare reform in the 1990s.
Gotten much worse.
Yeah.
Yes. Again, it's the same point that we're just kind of put on blinders or even a mask, blindfold to what's really going on in this country. Because why are now 47 million people receiving food stamps? And you know, some elected officials would have you believe that that's the new welfare and these are all people who somehow, I mean, you know, it's a number that happens to equal what Governor Romney said during the presidential campaign about the takers. Mm-hmm. That's such an overblown, overstated, I mean, fundamentally sort of defamatory statement about millions and millions of people. So, yes, there you are, where it's gotten to the point that there are people who are so badly off that the only income, as you said, and as I say in the book, is from food stamps. But it's also true that we used to have cash assistance, which was certainly a flawed. The welfare was flawed. It wasn't helping people get jobs. It needed to be changed. But we essentially changed it by leaving it to the states to decide what to do. And in many states, they don't do it anymore. And in the state of Wyoming, there are 600 people in the whole state who receive cash assistance. 4% of children who live in poor families. Gosh, that's just a stunningly low number. And so no wonder there's 6 million people. Now, just to be clear, if you only have food stamps, what that is, that's a third of the poverty line. That's a little over $6,000 a year for a family of three. So that's the reality of what's going on.
My guest today is Peter Edelman, professor of law at Georgetown University, his author of the last year's book, So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. He'll be the keynote speaker for the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation's National Symposium. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you know, we talked a little bit about food stamps. This is one of the success stories, really. we are helping people with food insecurity much more generously than we did 30 years ago. There have been other improvements too. SCHIP, the Children's Health Initiative. Your book sort of talks about these things. It says you're still very optimistic about the future at this point.
I am, because we did do things that were successful. We can again. I went with Robert Kennedy, for whom I worked when he was in the Senate, down to Mississippi in 1967. And we saw, in the United States, we saw children who had swollen bellies, so severely malnourished that they had swollen bellies and running sores on their arms and legs. And Robert Kennedy got started, and then others came along, George McGovern, Fritz Hollings of South Carolina. They were from various parts of the country saying this is a serious problem. And from that, we came to have the national food stamps program that we have now, where people have a legal right to get help. And as much poverty as we have, we don't have that kind of third world type of near starvation in our country. It's a tremendous success. And I just believe very strongly the 21st century is going to be a time, as we know, where the demographics are changing in the country, where we will be a majority-minority country. It's not just speculation. It's going to happen. And that doesn't mean that automatically things get better in terms of who we elect and how they behave once they're elected. But I think it has tremendous implications for some different governmental responses, for government's part of it. Government is only partly responsible, but for government's part of it. We also were going to see, with the baby boomers retiring, which does create a problem of supporting them in their retirement, but a lot of jobs are going to open up for young people coming along, and we need to respond to the challenge of making sure that they have the education and the training, which now requires, for so many jobs, the vast majority of jobs, you need some amount of post-secondary education. May not even be a two-year degree at a community college. It may be some kind of a certificate. But there's so many people who we're leaving behind in terms of making sure that they're ready for the 21st century jobs that we have. I think we have leadership, and we have people who are out doing some organizing and getting the word out, and especially with the demographic changes that we have that are already beginning to happen, I am optimistic.
All right. We'll look forward to your conversation in Tulsa for the Reconciliation Conference. Peter Adelman, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Georgetown law professor and anti-poverty activist Peter Adelman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be giving the keynote address for the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation's National Symposium. He'll be speaking Thursday at 5:30 at the Hyatt Regency, the site of the conference. You can learn more about the conference at jhfcenter.org. He's also the author of the book, So Rich, So Poor, Why It's So Hard to End Poverty in America. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.